Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm thrilled and honored to have as my guest tonight Jeanette Walls, author of The Glass Castle, published by Scribner's in 2005, now available in a very nice trade paperback. And first of all, Jeanette, thank you so much for appearing on the show today.
Thank you. It's my honor. Thank you.
And I would like to let the listeners know that Jeanette and I met down in Jefferson, Texas a few weeks ago. And I'd like to put a shout out to Kathy Patrick and the Pulpwood Queens. And I had a fabulous weekend, and I have a feeling you did as well.
Absolutely. I will second that. It was a great celebration of reading and of book sharing.
And Kathy is a force of nature.
Very well said, yes.
And so I wanted to, first of all, just acknowledge Kathy and the Pulpwood Queens and all the hard work they do to promote literacy in the United States.
Here.
And so, and Jeanette also bought a hat while she was down there, which I hope is, I think it's on Kathy's website. So that was really quite a weekend.
Yes, it was. It was quite fabulous. It is a fabulous hat, too, I have to say.
Yes. So, Jeanette, when we talk about The Glass Castle, one of the things I like is I read a book from cover to cover, and the introduction you say to John for convincing me that everyone who is interesting has a past. And one of the things I want to talk about in our interview is I come from an alcoholic family as well, but I think with The Glass Castle, you transcend just the alcoholic family into the fact that we all come from some kind of a past. And so I really liked the way you opened it with the tribute to your husband, that everyone who is interesting does have a past.
You know, Casey, my husband really did pull the story out of me, because for years and years I hid my past, and I was actually trying to run away from it and run away from who I really was. And I was living in New York City, and I was a reporter covering high society and celebrities, and I lived in fear that people would find out who I really was. And my husband eventually, before I married him, he did find out who I was, and he found out a little something about my past, and he basically duct taped me to the desk, and he said, "You are writing this, and you're writing it as a book, and you're telling everything." And while I was writing The Glass Castle, there was no doubt in my mind that once it came out, I would lose my job, I would lose my friends, and whatever meager standing in society I have. And because I've never been so wrong about anything in my life. First of all, I underestimated people's capacity for compassion and to really understand a story. But moreover, I completely underestimated the degree to which everybody out there does have something, whether or not they come from a hardscrabble background like I did, or, you know, sometimes they're very well-to-do and went off to boarding schools and lived on, you know, Park Avenue. People have things that they think makes them somehow different and inferior and weird, and I think very often that's the best thing you have going for you, and it's taken me this long to figure that out.
Sure, I understand. And with The Glass Castle, one of the things that like I say, my own experience, my father died of alcoholism at 46, and anyone who's grown up in an alcoholic family will read The Glass Castle, and they will understand it completely. It will read like almost like their life story, but someone who has not come from an alcoholic family might look at this and say, well, that couldn't actually happen. The family could
that
be
that has actually
way.
Happened to me a number of times. People have said, I just can't believe that somebody could live through all this. One person actually said, I can't believe that somebody who's an alcoholic would be as articulate and creative as Jeanette says that her father was. And to that I say, honey, you need to do a little research or maybe a little volunteer work, because alcoholics can also be charming and beguiling and manipulative, and my father was. And I don't depict him as a bad guy, because I don't believe he was, but he was a flawed human being. And a number of people have told me that what resonated for them in my story was that I didn't vilify my parents. You know, my dad wasn't a bad guy. My mother, who was not an alcoholic, was certainly a little bit loopy. But they, in addition to the There was craziness and chaos and deprivation in our family, but there was also a lot of love and intelligence. And I just think that it's important for everyone to focus on whatever it was that was good in your life and not to sort of dwell on the bad. I mean, my parents, you know, we moved around from town to town when I was growing up, and I lived in more towns than I could count by the time I was 10. And then when I was about 10, we moved to a little town in southern West Virginia where we didn't have indoor plumbing. And we often went without food. But on the upside, you know, my parents always put a very high emphasis on education and learning and reading. And I really do believe that my parents loved me. And I think it's important to learn from the bad and to cherish the good and to sort of just understand that for every downside, there's an upside, and to try to learn from that.
Absolutely. And when I reread the book preparing for the interview today, a couple things jumped out at me that resonated with me, because my father was my hero, and I understand the image of the glass castle that you use throughout the book. I really liked, and a couple of things that jumped out at me, I think maybe that are what you're talking about, is in the paper. I'm referring to the paperback edition now, but on page 38. You wanted to pull up a Joshua tree sapling, and you wanted to dig it up and replant it. And your mother frowned at you and said, "You'd be destroying what makes it special," she said. "It's the Joshua tree's struggle that gives it its beauty."
I love it that you zeroed in on that passage, because that happens to be one of my favorite passages that not a lot of critics have zeroed in on. And I think that was almost at the heart of the book, that my parents both did love challenges and struggles, and they felt that life shouldn't be easy, and that it was these difficulties that you learned from. They sort of were very suspicious of cushy, comfortable lives. I mean, certainly I think they went a little overboard in it, but they very much believed that you learned from hardships and that their children should not be coddled. And it's something that my mother very much believes to this day.
Mm-hmm. And then on page 56, there's a scene where the family's spread out in the living room, and you have a dictionary out, and your father's teaching you words, and if you disagreed with the definition, that you would write letters to the publishers debating the use of the word. And again, I think that is something that people think of an alcoholic or an alcoholic family, that would blow their mind. But my father was the same way. I had a dictionary. If I didn't know how to spell something, I had to go look it up in a dictionary and use it in a sentence.
Oh, you're kidding me. I love hearing that, because it was such a constant scene in my family with a dictionary, looking words up, and anytime we asked a question, we'd all research it together. And again, some people have questioned, you know, what? I thought he was a drunk. Well, he was a drunk, but he was a very intelligent drunk. And some people, it's interesting, some people who've read The Glass Castle see my father as just a belligerent loser, and see my mother as just the worst mother who ever existed, and believe that my two parents should have been locked up and sent to jail. And other people do see the good in them, and I think it's almost a litmus test for what you come to the story with. But yes, it's a very, very vivid memory for me.
Yeah. Now, there are also some scenes that, again, I can relate to, that do border on abuse. And the scene in particular is the one where you go to the bar. And reading that was very painful for me, because that there was a border there that was crossed. And
yeah,
in the world we live in today, you probably, there would have been an intervention then, you know, now, today. But at the time, you know, that went unpassed. But you were very honest in that scene. And that is the downside of the alcoholic family.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, again, you're very smart zeroing in on these passages, because you've hit on some very pivotal passages. And that episode, it happened when I was 13, and that summer was very significant for me, because it was the point at which I had to sort of face the truth about my father. There's no doubt that my father loved me, but when I really had to sit down and think about it, he loved or needed alcohol more. And, you know, it was the toughest scene for me to write, because I still love the memory of my father. And I almost felt like I was betraying him by writing that, but I felt I had to, because by not writing it, I would have been betraying the truth. Now, I do believe there's an upside to every down side to every bad event. And the upside to that summer was that it showed me loud and clear that I had to get out.
Yes.
That my father was not going to protect me, and that the only one who was really going to save me was myself. And if my father had behaved himself just a little bit more, I might have tried to have stayed at home and made things work. But it was that summer that I started saving up my money to go to New York City.
Yes. And another scene that jumped out at me was there's a scene where your mother has decided, it was the summer you're referring to, and you've had to take care of the family's finances, and your father's manipulated out of what starts out at $5 and goes to $20, and your mother quits teaching, and you spoke back to your mother because you realized that there was not going to be a paycheck coming in, and your father backed your mother on that, and he whipped you because you spoke back to her, and something in you, and I can relate to this myself, something in you snapped and you said, I'm getting out of here.
You know, it was really the first time that I can remember speaking back to my parents in that way, and just sort of saying, you guys are wrong. Because as wacky as my family was, and some people have called it dysfunctional, in another way we were very traditional, and Mom and Dad were very much the head of the household. And I sort of bought into that that structure. But that summer, when I was earning the only paycheck we had, but I was still being asked to respect, not only to respect my mother and father as the heads of the household, but to obey rules that just didn't make sense to me. Yes, you're absolutely right. Something snapped, and I said, this is wrong. This is wrong, and this is not going to work, and I cannot make it work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was no doubt in my mind when my mother went away for that summer and I was in charge of the household that I could straighten out my father.
Right.
That what he really needed was just a strong woman who would set rules and stick by them. And I thought that at age 13 I was strong enough to do that, and I wasn't. And it made me wake up and smell the coffee, honey.
Yeah. And then it literally broke my heart when your father stole the Oz fund that you and your sister had. When I read that scene again, it's just devastating.
Yeah, for your listeners, what happened is we put all of our money into this big pink plastic piggy bank that we were going to use as our escape fund for my older sister to go to New York City. And one reader, when she was reading the book, she told me that she was screaming at the book, "Don't put the money in the piggy bank!"
Yeah.
But it occurred to me that maybe I should hide the money. But since my sister and I and my brother were all contributing to the money, I knew that Dad would find it if we tried to hide it. So I thought it was out in the open. I knew Dad would try to get the money if we hid it, but I thought that it was out in the open and was this big joint effort that even Dad wouldn't sink that low, but I was wrong.
Yeah.
He stole our money.
Yeah. And I think what that probably shows you, Jeanette, is that you're not an alcoholic and he is.
Yes. Yes. And it also showed me that I had to get out no matter how.
Yeah.
Just find a way to get out.
Yeah.
And we did.
Yeah.
But it did break my heart a little bit that I had to stop believing in him and believe in myself instead.
Yeah, and you even said, Dad, you can go ahead and build your glass castle, but don't do it for me.
Yeah, I did.
Teenager,
the glass castle was something that while we were traveling all over the place, Dad was going to build us this great big house. It was going to be solar heated, and it would be made entirely out of glass, and the floors and ceilings and everything. Whenever times got tough, Dad would pull out the blueprints for the glass castle. And then finally that summer I realized the glass castle isn't going to be built, at least not for me. But in a way, and some people have accused me of being fatalistically optimistic, even though the physical structure of the glass castle was never built, what was more important is that Dad did give us dreams and a
yes.
hope for the future. And so that's why I named the book The Glass Castle, because even though we were never given the physical aspects of being comfortable, we were given the emotional hopes and dreams, which I think is more important. Ideally, you get both.
Yeah, no.
But if you're only going to get one, nurturing the heart and soul and the head, I think, are more important than the stomach.
I agree completely. Like I say, I lost my father when he was 46, and
wow.
The things that he left me Had he left me money, I don't think I would have become the person I've become. What he left me was has been of far greater use than money. And in your story, I think the Chuck Yeager interview is a perfect example of that, how he helped you with that interview. And to me, that seemed like a life-changing event for you too, because here you were in this little town and Chuck Yeager comes, and you were ready for Chuck Yeager. You interviewed him. And
absolutely. But you know, Casey, it's up to the individual how you're going to perceive it. I mean, it sounds to me like you had a childhood where you could also focus on the negative. You could feel sorry for yourself. So it really is a choice of how am I going to see these things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when Chuck Yeager came to town, it was my father's personal hero. And he stayed up all night with me and helped me come up with intelligent questions to ask this man who was the first human to go faster than the speed of sound. And, you know, it prepared me for a lot of things, but one of the things that it prepared me for is that when I came to New York, a number of people have asked me, how could you, you know, I was 17 years old when I came up here, I hadn't yet finished high school, how did you possibly make it? Well, the truth is that the sort of hard knocks life that I had growing up did prepare me in certain ways, but also my parents, both of my parents, but especially my father's constant encouragement and support. You know, among the many lies that my father told me was one that I could do whatever it was that I set out to do, and I believed it.
Sure.
If I'd been a little bit more intelligent, I might not have believed
those
right. lies, but it really helped me get through some tough times.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Now, the part of the glass castle, your sister moves to New York, you follow, eventually your whole family ends up there, and then the chapter, I had to laugh out loud, when how you found out that your parents had decided to move to New York City.
I'm getting ready for school and I'm listening to the radio and there's a traffic report on, and the van had broken down on the FDR Drive and the contents had spilled out all over the street and a dog had gotten out and was playing keep away with a cop, so there was this big traffic tie up and the DJs were having a good chuckle over the whole thing, but my heart really sank because it was the sort of thing that was happening to me all the time when I was growing up, and I felt so sorry for those people in the van, and that I didn't think a whole lot more of it until later that day. I get a call, and it was my mother. She said, "Jeanette comes, we've moved to New York," and I just my heart seized up, and I said, "Mom, did your van break down on the FDR Drive?" And she said, "How did you know?" And I told her it was on the radio, and she took that as a really good sign because they just moved to New York City and already they were famous.
Yeah. And the story from there on is really a fascinating story about how the different members of the family choose to become involved or not involved with your mother and father's really choice of lifestyle. And your mother is just such a fascinating character, and then I don't want to give away all of the story because a lot of people have read The Glass Castle, but a lot haven't. But you come to discover some things later on towards the end of the book that about some assets of your mother's that had to completely blow your mind at the time when you discovered this.
Exactly. And one of the conclusions that I've come to is that it was so much my parents' choice to live the way that they did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it's many people, I'm not going to say everyone's choice, but for the most part, people do have the lives that they want, that they make for themselves. My parents could have changed their lives.
Yes.
A lot of people ask me if I'm bitter or angry because they hadn't, but for my part, you know, I'm very, very happy with where I am in life. I have no reason to complain. So people say, well, you know, what did you do with your anger? How did you get over your anger? The truth is, I have a fabulous job. I have a great life. There's no reason for me to be angry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't matter how you got where you are. What matters is that you're happy with where you are. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that I could have had a very different childhood if my parents had chosen to have a more conventional life. They were completely capable of it. My mother's highly educated. My father's a very smart man. But they did choose this crazy life. My mother described herself as an excitement addict. But as far as I'm concerned, it's okay. You know, you learn a lot from your from your hardships, from your life. You know, before I came out of the closet about my past, a very well-to-do friend of mine, she wanted me to go with her on this Outward Bound expedition. I'd never heard of Outward Bound. I didn't know what it was. And so she was saying to me, oh, it's this great program. You go off and you go out to the wilderness and you survive. And I didn't say anything, but I'm thinking, honey, the first 17 years of my life was an Outward Bound. And it was the funniest thing I ever heard about that. Rich people got to pay for their
hardships. You're actually going to pay for this?
But then when I thought about it for a while, it started making a little bit more sense because this is a very, very intelligent, capable woman, but everything she has in life was handed to her on a silver platter. And I think deep down inside there's a gnawing doubt that she could have done these things on her own. And there's no doubt in my mind that she could, but she doesn't know that, so she was never able to prove it to herself. So if you have a life where you earned everything you have, that there's a certain comfort to that, a certain sense of self that comes from that. You know, you can also feel sorry for yourself because of it, but it's your choice. You have to choose the way that you want to live.
Yeah. I almost, at this point, I'm 48, Jeanette, I almost feel sorry for people that had a normal childhood.
I'm with you on that one. They certainly have more trouble digging up the good for a memoir, don't they?
Yeah. I remember the photographer Diane Arbus took pictures of quote-unquote freaks, and I loved her work, and she wrote that she felt that people that were freaks were the true aristocrats in the world because most people are born and they try to avoid trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And that freaks are born into the world with trauma. And so they understand life from the day they're born, and the rest of us try to figure it out until we hit a traumatic event.
Wow, I love that. That's very intelligent. Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that, though. And I think that, you know, if you grow up with too easy of a childhood, then you expect life to be easy. And it's interesting. A lot of psychologists have been saying that that a number of parents, very well-intending parents, in trying to give their children lives that are trauma-free, are actually doing them a huge disservice. I'm not enough of an expert to know whether or not that's the case,
right.
But a number of people have asked me about, in terms of the glass castle, how can we teach our children to appreciate things that they have? And you grew up with so little. And, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but I do think that this is just a society that has so much materially that, you know, I hope people just don't take these things for granted. I mean, when you grow up like I did without indoor plumbing, there are so many things that you will just never take for granted. I never will ever take for granted a hot bath, for example, or
right.
even a flush toilet. Really,
right.
These things are all incredible luxuries.
Yeah, I understand. And The Glass Castle, which is what we've been discussing today, published by Scribner's, part 5 is Thanksgiving, and I love that part of the book. It's with your husband, John, and your family. And I'm wondering, Jeanette, when you were writing that, did you revise that? That when you look at when you were looking at the length of how much time you were going to devote to part 5, Thanksgiving, versus the rest of the book? Part 5 is a relatively short part of the book, but it's very powerful. And when you first started, with the first draft of the book, was part 5, was that kind of the length you wanted it to be?
Actually, part 5 was. Part 1 was meeting my mother initially, and then part 5, the first and the fifth part is sort of short. The part that was originally much longer was the whole New York section. Part 2 is my life in the desert. Part 3 was living in West Virginia. 4 was living in New York City. And what originally was a lot longer was my discussion of New York and New York society types, because one of the things that really struck me from living on Park Avenue and getting to know these people well, and these people who I had always admired and envied from a distance, was seeing them up close and realizing that they didn't all have the answer to happiness either. And I mean, this is overly obvious perhaps, but I mean, everybody, it's such a cliche that money doesn't buy happiness, but when you're as broke as I was when I was growing up, you think that having all that wealth would make you happy. And then seeing up close, it was sort of shocking the degree to which, you know, these people who had so much money, they were always suing their siblings or they wouldn't speak to their parents or something like that. But I ended up cutting that way back because it sounded sort of churlish and just felt a little bit like like the Nanny Diaries revisited.
Yeah.
But yeah, the New York, the Thanksgiving section where I reunite with my family, that was always sort of short-ish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what I took away from part five is that one of the things that just drives me crazy is when I hear people say that people that grow up in dysfunctional families can't achieve intimacy and can't develop full relationships. And I just think that's such baloney. I'm married to a wonderful woman. I have a very wonderful marriage. And people that come from damaged families can't have health. They can have healthy relationships and do have healthy relationships.
Well, I think we treasure it all the more.
I think so, too.
You see stability and happiness and somebody who cares about you and understanding and, you know, the potential for normal lives. You say, this is so great. You know, I love, you know, I'm very happily married right now, and I'm so, so grateful. So that is why I said it on Thanksgiving, is because, you know, it's just so much to be thankful for, having food on the table and having a house to have it all in. It's this incredible blessing, and I think that people should be just constantly grateful for these everyday blessings.
Yes. And, Jeanette, before we wrap up here, I wanted to, when we were in Texas, this topic came up, and it's the hot topic, and I don't want to beat it to death, but the James Frey memoir, one, if you go back to ancient Greek storytelling, you have logos, ethos, and pathos is the emotion of sympathetic pity. And I think one of the things, like when I read The Glass Castle, there's a lot of painful things in there, and they were all true, and you didn't have to make any of them up. And when you were writing this, you were relying on your memory, your imagination. And for people that are writing memoirs, or for this big debate that's going on, how do you kind of feel about this? You can't have fact checkers go through and check everything. What's kind of your take on this, if you could? I know it's a difficult question, but how do you feel about that?
Well, I think memoir writing is all about honesty. It's all about just really being honest. It's about the truth, not just factual truth, but emotional truth as well. And it's very hard to get at. In the first version that I wrote of The Glass Castle, the problem with it was so emotionally distanced from what had really happened. And it took me about 6 weeks to write the first version, and I spent about 5 years really getting at the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it was, you know, did this really happen this way? Could it have happened this way? I didn't, as you said, I didn't fact check it. That's not what a memoir is about. I did bounce a lot of it off my brother. But who's got this incredible memory, but it's a matter of really getting at what happened and how did you feel about it. And I think when a memoir is successful, you're sharing your experiences. You're sort of saying, look, this is what I lived, this is what I went through. And if you can take the reader on your journey, the journey of your life, and share those experiences with that person, with the reader, and if you're successful, then the reader can learn something from your life. And if it's not honest on the most profound level, if you're just not painfully honest with yourself and with your reader, then there's just no point in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about getting at the truth. And this has been one of the incredibly gratifying things for me, is that while I was writing this, I was thinking, you know, my life was so strange and so bizarre. For a memoir or biography to be meaningful, it has to be somewhat universal. And who's going to possibly relate to this wacky story? It's just so out there. But the stunning thing to me has been how many people have connected with it. People like you, who, you know, you seem like a perfectly normal person. you have sort of seized on, oh my gosh, this is similar and this is true, because I know, because I experienced something like it. And it's been, for me, a truly amazing experience, and that I realized, you know, in the isolation of my own shame, I thought I was the only one who went through this sort of thing. So having written it, I feel sort of like Alice through the Looking Glass in reverse. I've gone from this world that was sort of scary and distorted to a world filled with compassionate and understanding people with whom I can connect emotionally. And a number of readers have told me, you know, the same, that they feel, oh my gosh, somebody with a story like mine. So I think that to violate the truth, to have untruth, it's just, it affects offends me so terribly. I mean, first of all, so far as making stuff up, I could never have made this story up. I mean, it would just never occur to me to put four kids in the back of a U-Haul. But, you know, just getting at the truth of my parents and what was inside them and what really happened, you know, if you're sharing your story and you're dishonest about it, it's not only useless, I think it's potentially damaging, because you're presenting somebody with a sort of a misleading map to life. And I think that that's just, it just violates all the wonderful, I'm a big fan of memoirs. Mm-hmm. And it's a shared experience. And then to lie to somebody about your experience, it's violating a trust that the writer has with the reader.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree completely. And I hope we don't go overboard in the other direction, because I agree with you, is there's an implicit trust between the reader and the writer.
Very well said, yeah.
And Jeanette, I want to tell you, I thank you so much for taking time out of what I know is a busy schedule to talk to the listeners today.
Well, I thank you.
And I recommend The Glass Castle. I put on the homepage that it's the kind of book you read and you call your sister or your brother and say, this is a book you have to read. And I'm just so happy for you that you've had this success. You must just be overwhelmed with all of the success and acclaim that has come from the book. Is just absolutely mind-boggling.
I am just ecstatic. So happy. I feel so, I'm shocked by it all, but overwhelmed and overjoyed. Yes.
Good. Well, continued success, and hopefully I'll see you at the next Girlfriend Weekend, wherever that is.
You got it. Thank you so much.
Okay. Take care, Jeanette.